It's the Scotty Myers Show.
Hey, welcome to this week's edition of the show. I'm your host, Scotty Myers. This week, we've got a really cool guest, Todd Kearns, a guy who has been a fixture on the Canadian music scene with bands like Age of Electric and Took, and he had a solo project. But internationally, he's probably best known as a member of Slash featuring Miles Kennedy and the Conspirators. And Slash, they have a new album coming out in February. So had a chance to catch up with Todd, talk about recording the new album and a ton of the other projects that he's working on. So without further ado, Mr. Todd Kearns.
It's been a little while since we've chatted. How have you been holding up through pandemic world?
It's been crazy. You know, it took me a second to unwind because, you know, my life, as it currently is like 10 things on the go and juggling multiple projects and whatnot. And then all of a sudden COVID happens and you're like, so I can just sit here now? No one's looking for me. No one needs me. And once I kind of, you know, got the hang of that, I really got the hang of that. And now it's kind of in COVID brain, trying to get back to, I got a bunch of stuff to do. Like, but I want to watch, you know, a full season of something today on Netflix, you know.
Yeah, you're suddenly very needed again.
I know, it happened so quickly. In 2021, like, I took on a bunch of recording projects, and I was kind of like, well, yeah, okay, that sounds good, because 2021, it looks like we're not going to be gigging much. So I take on all this stuff, and then all of a sudden gigs start to kind of present themselves, and I'm like, hey, wait a second. I've been getting false information here. I thought we were, like, kind of taking it easy this year. But so now I'm doing, like, the work of two or three guys, which, you know, good problem to have.
Very, very good problem to have. Now, the new Slash Miles Kennedy and the Conspirators album, how did you guys record that one with, you know, obviously COVID and all? Were you just recording parts kind of all across the country, or...?
No, that's the fascinating thing about it, is we literally got on a tour bus, made our way across, well, into the middle of the country to Nashville, and basically lived in this bubble of the studio and this massive rental property that we were all staying at. And, you know, basically did the COVID thing, did tests, we did all the things, and... just sort of kept our bubble tight. Unfortunately, it didn't really work out because a bunch of us got COVID anyway, but that story's out there for the world to know. But we did manage to make the record. This is back in April. So, I mean, we were like way on top of it. We thought we should jump on this while everybody's sort of sitting around before they all get pulled into different directions. But it took a long time to get pulled into different directions, but it happened, you know.
What was that experience like? Kind of, I heard NBA players when they did like that playoff bubble, they kind of got really antsy and frustrated, and that was at Disney World. What was it like for you guys being kind of basically locked in a mansion, you know, having to work?
It was surreal, but it's kind of not unusual in the recording process. I find that you sort of, I don't know, you know, I read like old Led Zeppelin stories and it sounds like, oh, it's just a party all the time. But most of the time when we're in making records, it seems like we're fairly, it's kind of like locked down anyway. You know what I mean? Like, you're just sort of like, you're there all day recording and then you go and crash and then you go right back to the studio. So it really is not that different. I mean, it's Nashville. We all have a lot of friends in Nashville, and there's so many great things to see in Nashville and great restaurants and stuff like that that we certainly would have taken in had we been able to kind of to do that. But what we had was literally had like a food service delivering us food. So the intention was that we would just never leave the house, you know what I mean? And it wasn't until the COVID thing happened that it got really... you know, all work, no play makes Jack a dull boy. But you sort of, then all of a sudden a bunch of us were, you know, okay, well, now you guys got to chill in this house until you test negative. So that's when it got really surreal. So the weirdest thing about making that record is we made it very live. We recorded all the songs, in about 5 or 6 days, we had recorded everything. except for some overdubs. So, and then we got, you know, shut down because of the situation. Slash and Frank both went in and did some guitar overdubs and whatnot. Not a lot, though. I mean, the funny thing about that record is it's very live off the floor. And Miles even sang quite a few songs with us. So there's not a lot of... usually a record is made, drums are recorded, you're focusing on the drums. The drums get edited. They get gridded on a click track. And when I say usually, I'm saying by today's modern standards, this is sort of the way things happen. Then I'll put some bass on it, then the guitar players start to come in and do their thing. And then the vocals end up at the very end. This time it was, you know, we had kind of been sending around ideas long before and rehearsed the heck out of it, and then went in and just sort of knocked it out with no click tracks, amps in the all in the same room with the drums. We kept talking about like the first Black Sabbath album and early Aerosmith albums and all this kind of stuff. Like, let's do it like those. And I'm like, okay, wow, great, you know. And I've since made, like, you know, worked on three or four different records now in the more modern sense after that. But it was very ambitious and very adventurous. So once we got into the, you know, a bunch of us got sick, then we were doing some of the overdubs, like harmony vocals and stuff like that, with a remote system in lockdown. Like, I was singing my backup vocals in a pool house out back on a... on a different rig entirely. It was very surreal.
The singing pool boy.
Hey, it sounds like a good service I could provide.
It does. I think, you know, listen, if the rest of the music stuff doesn't pan out, singing pool boy, LA needs it, I think.
I think it's all the pool boy stuff that I would be really challenged at. Well, he sings okay, but he's a terrible pool boy.
And you chose Nashville, and this just brought it, like, is the rock world trying to take over Nashville? Because I know, like, you guys went and recorded there. I think, like, Hailstorm does a bunch of stuff, and I think Lizzie actually lives in Nashville. Is rock trying to kick country out of Nashville? Because I'm all for it.
I don't think that's ever going to happen, but I think because it's such a music place, which I think is the exciting thing about Nashville. When you go there, you're like, what I always say is, it's interesting going to Los Angeles or, you know, even Vegas. Like, I live in Vegas and it's an entertainment-based city, or you go to Los Angeles and again, it's, you know, there's music there, but there's also everything. But when you go to Nashville, it is 100% music. You know, you get to the airport, there's, you know, guitars and you know, all music stuff, and then you get to the hotel and it's all very music-based. And so I think that, you know, there's a great deal of cross-pollinating from country into rock and whatnot. So there's a lot of them there. Like, a lot of the guys we grew up on, rock dudes, a lot of them are in Vegas. And it's really fascinating. And I think a lot of it's because, you know, it's a music industry there. It's the songwriting and all that kind of stuff. So you got your Tom Kiefer, you've got your Kip Winger, you've got Skid Row, you've got... Like, when I go out there, I'm like, damn, dude, it's like the 80s out here. 80s rock out there. But, you know, it's pretty exciting, and it's pretty infectious, actually, the just being surrounded by all that talent. And I think mostly because Cobb was there, Dave Cobb, the producer, was the guy who, you know, that sort of really caught Slash's attention. Slash is always wanting to make records as live as possible. In fact, it's the fact that this got a little bit derailed with, you know, with a worldwide pandemic. It might have even been more live if we'd been able to kind of, you know, just see the whole thing through. But yeah, it was fascinating. So when you listen to The River Is Rising, the first single, the only thing really overdubbed is my harmony vocal. And I think maybe a couple little guitar things. But I think even Miles' vocal was recorded live with the band. It's pretty fascinating.
It does sound like a raw, like, and I mean raw in a good way. Like, it does sound like a raw rock song and a bit of a throwback. And that would explain it, kind of that live, off-the-floor feel.
Exactly. Like we're talking no click tracks. And usually even when you're trying to record a band live, like, we always try to capture... rhythm guitars and bass with the drums, because there's so much focus on getting the drums correct that when we're trying to record everything else, So usually the amps are in separate booths to try and, you know, separate them from, so you're not having all this guitar noise bleeding into the drums and microphones and whatnot. But this time it was like, you know, there was a lot of like, nah, let's do it like an old, you know, like they did back in the day. And when you go to Sun Studios or Abbey Road, any of the old school studios, you realize that, you know, that's how they did it. When you listen to your favorite old school recordings, Little Richard or any of those things, it's like, that's how they did it. They just sort of went into a room together, turned the microphones on, and just played. And I know there's, you know, probably an argument to be made that, well, but those songs could sound so much better if you're able to separate all these things. I go, but I think so. And with music, so much is about vibe, isn't it? It's so much about the feeling of it rather than the sort of like perfection sometimes. Like you can sit around and try and like run a click track on old Led Zeppelin songs or Beatles or Stone songs, and you'll be surprised how much the tempo wavers and moves and how much sort of guitars and vocals can be mildly out of tune here and there. But it's part of the realness and the charm that we sort of subconsciously are attracted to, you know what I mean? So we are getting more and more into a world with pop and whatnot, and even in modern rock that is sort of seeking out perfection as much as possible. But I don't know that perfect makes it better. In my opinion.
No, that's a very, very fair statement. Sometimes the beauty is in the flaws. Obviously, you've been doing the thing with Slash for a little while. Was there any concern whatsoever that he may not come back to this, especially as the GNR thing went so well?
To be honest, it's funny because I brought this up yesterday. I remember saying, you know, back in the day, every time we've done something together, I kind of felt like, well, that might be it. You know what I mean? I think we do a record and do a tour, and that's kind of, I always assume it's kind of high five, and, you know, I never really took it for granted until just before he went back to GNR. So it's kind of like the comfort level had grown so much around the World on Fire record for us, you know, because we'd been hammering it for, you know, over 5 years at that point. Jeez, I don't even know how long that is. I started playing with Slash in 2010, so it'll be 12 years in March, and the Conspirators will have been together 10 years in March. So it's a very weird thing to objectively take a step back and realize how much time has passed. But I remember having a conversation with our manager about it once, and he just said, look, there's no reason that this will ever stop. It's sort of like, I've always sort of treated it as a project, you know what I mean? Like, one thing to be a band where it's 100% the only thing you do, and you know, so every year is sort of like a preparation of recording and then touring and then recording and then touring, and you just sort of cycle this thing out till the end of time. But with our thing, because Miles has always been the lead singer for Alter Bridge, it's always made it sort of you know, we do it when we can do it. We do it when we can get together, and as long as we kind of look at each other and say, yeah, that sounds like fun. You know, things have gotten crazier and crazier. Miles started doing solo stuff. Frank started playing in Mammoth WVH, and, you know, myself and Fitz always have a million things going on, too. But that's part of what this is, you know. It's sort of like, you know, there isn't sort of like an idea that you're in this thing and that's the only thing you're in. It's never really been that way. So when Guns N' Roses came back, I was the first one to say, well, you have to do that. You have to go and do that. That's your legacy. You have to take back your mantle, take back your crown, man. And, so again, you know, we had been working on material prior to that. So when the Living the Dream record came out, it was during an entire process of, I guess, 2017, that record came out. We had done a whole, you know, whole lot of work. So it was the Conspirators was still very much on our mind. It was just trying to deal with all the other scheduling that had to work around all that. At any point, you know, I've never taken any of this for, like I said, I wasn't necessarily that I'd taken it for granted by the time Guns came back. It was more a case of I had just grown very comfortable with the way things were. With Slash now, it's sort of like, and with Guns now, it's sort of more a thing of like, you know, anything can happen. I mean, that's the interesting thing about this business is that, you know, there's a lot of Guns activity and new songs that are popping out here and there. And to me, I'm always sort of treating it as like, you know, when we can do this and when we can get together, I make the best of it and really enjoy it. And then we all, again, high five, good game, and everybody goes off in their different directions. And if we find our way back to each other, great. If we don't, the funny thing is, in my mind, I just know we will. You know, it might take longer and longer. It might be a 5-year gap. But I'm betting we'll probably at some point just, hey man, what are you doing? That's the funniest thing about Slash is you just, it's never like a plan. It's just sort of like, hey man, what are you doing? And then it sort of bubbles up into like almost like a relapse rather than an actual plan. You just kind of like, next thing you know, you're working on songs and a plan starts to formulate, you know?
Yeah, you know what? It probably keeps the quality high because, you know, sometimes those bands, you get into the machine and then the songwriting suffers because you have to put stuff out. Whereas if you guys are just doing this, you know, when you want to, it's when there's a spark, right?
Totally. And I think the key word is there when you want to, you know, not when you have to. I think that's sort of the joy of this is it's, you know, I mean, it's Slash's baby. You know, I mean, it's sort of like he... whether he's in Guns or Velvet or any of that stuff, it's sort of like this thing is, you know, 100% his baby, you know, which we're a collective, but you know, he sort of for the first time in his life, other than the Snake Pit, able to kind of do, you know, what he'd really like to do. Basically he has a bunch of ideas and we help put those together. Miles puts words and melody to them and that's it. You know, there's no real big secret to how it's done. It's mostly done because we want it to happen and we enjoy it. And that's sort of the end of it. It really isn't sort of like no one's sort of got a, like there's no clock ticking or any of that kind of stuff that makes it sort of less fun. You know, and I think that's the most important thing about all of this is it should be fun. You know what I mean? And I think that's, you know, when you do this for a living, the best thing is realizing that, you know, sometimes it can be stressful and tough and things get lean, things get crazy, you get stretched too thin, but, you know, it's sort of like you have to stop once in a while and go, well, I'm not digging a ditch. You know, I've done ditches, you know, I've done other stuff that, you know, isn't fun. This is the fun stuff. So we appreciate that.
And you mentioned a couple of anniversaries there, like for you playing with Slash and the Conspirators. You've had a couple as well, like with your other projects, because last year, the 2020 would have been the 30th anniversary of the Age of Electric debut album. And then this year would be 30 years for Aphrodisiac Smile, which is the first video I remember seeing of Age of Electric. Do you have any plans to celebrate any of those milestones?
You know, we always talk about that stuff, and the next thing you know, it's kind of like, because you have to plan these things so many years in advance, but the next thing you know, you're like, oh my God, how did this happen? Like, we're like, you know, like I remember when we were talking about the 20th anniversary of Make a Pest a Pet, so Pest came out in 97, and we, you know, we got together and did a run in 2017, and that was, it was surreal to be able to, but the funniest thing about it, in a much different sort of microcosm kind of way, Slash went back to his old band Guns N' Roses and I went back to my old band Age of Electric, and you know, in a very much smaller kind of version of what Guns were doing, but you know, it was very surreal to be looking back at these things from a milestone position, and 30 years doesn't seem that long now. Like, it's so surreal, like, to bring up like, oh, we did that 30 years ago, and you just feel like, it feels like time has lapsed, but it feels more like 15 years or something like that. Like, it feels like recent history. Yeah, it's a funny thing. Like, I know that the untitled record, Age of Electric, came out in 93. Or was it 93? No, the Ugly EP came out in 93. And then the White album that had Ugly and Untitled on it came out in 95. So a few of those are starting to kind of present themselves where I'm like, oh, maybe we should start thinking about that, because a lot of the Age of Electric catalog doesn't exist in Apple Music or Spotify or any of that kind of stuff. So we have Make a Pest a Pet up there. We have the Pretty EP, which we put out in 2017. So now it's a case of like digging into, first of all, Ugly and Untitled and Enya, and then starting to think about the really far back stuff, which is Aphrodisiac Smile and all that stuff, an album called The Latest Plague, which was only ever released on compact on cassette tape, believe it or not. So that goes to show you what kind of time we're dealing with. You know, a format that's dead before the most recent format died. You know what I mean? It's such a surreal thing, but yeah, it's funny. I don't spend a lot of time looking back. In reality, it doesn't feel like looking back. It feels like you're just looking at your entire discography or catalog or history, really. It just feels like it's all part of the same thing, even though it's not currently really active.
Yeah, and you need to get that stuff online. And you know what? Like, if you went back, when you went back to AOE and Slash went back to GNR, you guys should have been the opener. I'm a little upset. with Slash on this here.
That was a missed opportunity.
Huge, huge missed opportunity.
That would have been fun.
It would have been a blast. I mean, you know, like I saw the GNR tour in Toronto and Billy Talent opened. And believe me, I love the boys in Billy Talent and they're a great band, but a little AOE reunion on that show would have been good too. I'm just saying.
That would have been huge. Yeah. Cause I mean, you know, the funniest thing about it was, you know, before we split was like, opening a, Our Lady Peace show. I think one of our last shows, I think the last show really before we kind of separated was, Cops Coliseum in Hamilton. So it's surreal how, like, but the weird thing is we've always kept in touch. So it's one thing when a band, that's the weirdest thing about music, man. It's like when people say, you know, oh, that band broke up or that band's not playing together, I always kind of go, oh, they'll get back together. There's always a reason to get back together. And they usually do. They usually find a reason to, you know, there's some benefit or some charity will come up that make the guys kind of go like, hey, we should get together and. You know what I mean? Like, sometimes it's not all the original guys, but bands usually find their way back to each other. It's the weirdest thing. Like, music really kind of keeps you sort of tethered together in a funny way. Like, Age of Electric, in certain people's minds, I will always be the guy from Age of Electric. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, you know, so we will always be sort of bound together in this weird, timeless, you know, frozen in time kind of experience.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, for me, one of my favorite Todd Kearns projects was the solo album. I was a huge fan of that one.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. One of the things that you worked on, you mentioned you worked on a bunch of projects as well as outside of the Slash one, was you did a track for the Heels show. Are you a wrestling fan?
You know, what's so funny is I was around, like, you know, when I was a kid, I remember Stampede Wrestling out of Calgary.
Yeah.
Calgary, Alberta, where it was like, you know, like the Heart Foundation and those kind of guys all came from that. A lot of guys came from that whole thing. So the WWF at the time, we weren't even really aware of, but I assumed that they were sort of around. It was mind-blowing to see how big that thing became, and how big that thing is. You know, I wouldn't call myself a massive fan because I think I was always, you know, a great appreciator of it. And I think Bret Hart, being that he was one of the first guys I ever saw do it, has always remained my favorite. You know, I'm friends with Chris Jericho and a few other guys that do it, and it's such a surreal thing because of the entertainment value of it. Is what's so interesting is you understand that it's entertainment. It's there's a great deal of athleticism involved in it, obviously, but it's really an amazing thing to watch happen. How guys like Chris, I've known Chris during phases where he is the face, and I've seen him through phases where he's the heel, and it's such a really interesting thing to watch. And that's what I really enjoyed about that TV series, Heels, is, you know, I actually talked to Chris about it. I go, after, you know, in watching that show, I go, is this kind of like how this thing works? Is this, like, does this seem like a legit? He goes, actually, it's pretty legit. There are tons of those sort of smaller leagues in, like, more regional areas that have these kind of, you know, like, smaller wrestling scenes, you know? And I'm like, wow, it's such a crazy... I guess it's the equivalent of, like, being a club band, you know what I mean? Or, you know, like the local cover scene or something like that. And then they have, like, wrestlers who are sort of guys who sell cars during the day or are mechanics, and then they go out on the weekend and they wrestle, you know? And I'm like, so cool, you know? So it was really surreal having that song in there because it was, a couple of my friends, a couple of guys from the Toque band are involved in this stuff too, where they've been like, they get songs placed in the last Bill and Ted movie and stuff like that. So this just came out of nowhere. And I was literally just leaving Los Angeles. Like, I had the car packed up. Me and my wife were in LA for, I think, a Slash thing or rehearsals or whatever. And we were just driving back. And then I got a call from Corey Churko saying, "Hey dude, do you think you'd come over right now and sing on this track?" And I'm like literally one exit away from him. Yeah, I guess. So we just went back, and my wife and his wife went out and had some, you know, food or whatever. And then we just kind of rattled off this song for an hour or hour and a half, whatever. And, you know, so you sing something like that, it goes out of your mind, like, as soon as you walk out the door, because you've literally just heard the track. You walk in, okay, you sing it, you leave, and then, like, a few months later, it's on television, and you go, this is really weird. But it's been really cool. It's been really cool to you know, to get that sort of, to see it kind of nationally out there, and it's so surreal whenever the one character, we're his walk-on music, you know, his walk-out music is, you know, that song. So every time he walks out into the ring, that song starts, and I'm like, that weird sort of sense of like, why do I know this song? Oh, hey, that's me.
And you know, it's there's a lot of parallels between the lives, right? Like, you know, as a band, like you were mentioning, like you start off doing like covers or whatever. As a wrestler, you start off in an indie, and then you just hope to grow up within the business. And there's a lot of travel, a lot of parallels between wrestlers' lives and rock star lives.
The other parallels is how hard those guys party. It's mind-blowing, actually. Mind you, I've always felt that in sports in general. I feel like, you know, people think rock bands are, you know, going wild on the road. I remember, like, you know, like a lot of my friends who were hockey players and stuff like that, those guys would go wild. And the craziest thing about it was that they'd have to get up in the morning and go to, I was going to call it rehearsal, which is it's supposed to show you how music and theater-minded I am. They had to get up and go hockey rehearsal. You know, they had to get up and practice in the morning, and I'm like, oh, fuck that. You know, it's like, the guys like us, we're like, you know, we do this kind of stuff, and it's sort of, you know, it's part of the course. But, I mean, we're all much quieter, slower, kinder, gentler gentlemen now.
And you know what, in some ways I think rock is missing that a little bit right now. I think some of the new bands are too healthy.
There is a great deal of that, isn't there? Like, I just saw the Stones the other night, and no one, you know, those guys have lived more lives than anybody should, and they're here to tell the tale. And I really don't get the impression that Keith is sober. You know, I'm sure there's probably a cocktail involved or whatever. Yeah, it's sort of like, I've always been sort of the weird anomaly, because I was always sort of, I was never really a big drinker, and I was never really a big partier. I was always sort of so obsessed with making music and being as good as I could be the next day. Because you have to keep in mind that the travel, the lack of sleep, the jet lag, the exhaustion, all of that comes into play. And I just never wanted to be that guy that's like the weak link on stage, like, oh boy, you know, like the one guy who said, I've been the weak link, you know, and I've played with many weak links, depending on the day or the night or the weekend or what's happening, you know, where you just kind of like, you know, that person's had one drink too many or whatever. But, you know, when we were younger, it was sort of like more a case of just, you know, it's just an ongoing party. You know, it's like you just feel, I can't believe we get to do this, you know, and you never really think of the long game. Because it's not a long game. You know, you're a kid. You're thrilled to be doing it at all. And then, you know, then you become a quote-unquote seasoned professional, and you know that you have to kind of, or you want to make sure you're presenting your best game day in, day out. And that's where, you know, that's when you start to kind of play that game of like, okay, well, do I want to be, you know, I never wanted to be that kind of like, how was the gig last night? Well, Todd fell down drunk halfway through the show and they stopped. You know, it's like, which is always a great story when you hear about it. Steven Tyler was so wasted, they, you know, they only played 20 minutes, and you're like, oh my God. But then you're like, it's a cool story to hear now, but I sure wouldn't want to have been at that show going like, hey dude, I paid like, you know, money for these tickets, you know?
Yeah.
But you know, it's, now it's, you know, I think people take it pretty serious. I mean, the whole, no one really thought of this game as a long game. Even rock and roll in the 70s was kind of like, oh, this will last for a little while. Everybody will have to go back to getting real jobs and, you know, or whatever, get chewed up by the music industry and spat out. And then you look at the Stones, who were like pushing 80, and they're rocking harder than most of us. And I'm like, wow, it's like, you know, you just never think of that stuff until you sort of like see it in front of you.
Yeah, I mean, I just think back to when I was a kid and I was kind of like living vicariously through Motley Crue, going like, I want to grow up and be those guys. And then I see some bands now and I get healthy lifestyle, but when they're doing an interview going, oh, you know, we hit the treadmill every day and we eat healthy, I'm like, well, now I am you. Like, that's what I do. You do what I can't do, please.
Yeah, and the Motley Crue example. I mean, the fact that every member of Motley Crue and every member of Guns N' Roses of the original lineups are all alive is mind-blowing, considering that no one lived harder than those people. You know what I mean? Like Motley was, I don't think anybody will live as hard as those guys did. And Guns was even harder in a different way, like in a much, yeah, you know, more like in a, you know, way more intense, heavy drug way, you know? And, you know, all those people are still with us. You know, they're all still with us to tell the tale. So it tells you something. And Keith Richards is still with us. You know, so, you know, and then some, you know, and there's a lot of, we've lost so many along the way that, you know, that you wonder what was different with that scenario versus this scenario. Because for all intents and purposes, you know, if it was sort of like, oh, that guy didn't make it, you'd be like, oh, that's totally understandable.
Yeah.
The lifestyle those guys were living. Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. It's like somehow their chemical concoction was like fermenting them somehow or something. It's very weird.
Kind of, yeah. Well, you know, I know all the Guns guys. So, you know, Duff McKagan had a pancreas explode or some crazy thing, you know, and Flash had a pacemaker put in, and Steven Adler had strokes. You know, it's like, these guys did serious damage to themselves, but are here to tell the tale. You know what I mean? And we all know that Nikki Sixx died at some point for 2 minutes and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And again, these are all great stories, but I guarantee you it was not fun at the time for anybody involved. It's why Duff McKagan is in the shape he's in. He's like, you know, when you've flown that close to the sun, it's like, you just want to make sure you're in the best shape of your life, and nobody's in better shape than Duff. It's mind blowing.
He looks in good shape. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, and he's what, pushing 60 or something. And, you know, he looks amazing.
Yeah. It's insane. And then another project you were involved in came out kind of today as we're talking, and that was, you're involved in a new Tea Party single. How did that come together?
We co-wrote that song together a long time ago. I don't even know what the math is. 15 years ago, I want to say. An earlier version of it. And then they decided to release this version and asked me to sing on a portion of the song. And I'm like, of course. Always loved that song. In fact, I actually went back today and listened to the original version that we did, which is my voice singing the song. I don't know what we intended to do with that song, but yeah, I've loved those guys for, you know, since the 90s, and we've all been very tight, and I'm always happy to have the funny thing is they released a Led Zeppelin song a few years ago that I also sang on, so I always have this weird sort of connection to those guys that seems to live on. And you know, I'm a big fan, and I'm a big fan of them as people, so I'm always happy to do anything with those guys.
They're an odd Canadian band in that, like, working in radio, and I see, like, okay, this band's getting this many songs played, this band, you know, they're a band, they've had hits, but I almost feel like sometimes, and I don't mean this in a disparaging way, but sometimes people kind of forget how successful Tea Party was and is.
I agree. I think they're one of those anomaly bands where it's kind of like, first of all, they don't really sound like the kind of band that comes from Canada. They have this sort of, I first saw those guys way before, well, before they were signed, before the first album, and they were, you know, I remember seeing them in a place in Toronto, and I thought they were like really Zeppelin-y, really Hendrix-y. You know, he sort of, at the time, I didn't really kind of equate this sort of Jim Morrison-y type thing that they would kind of lay on Jeff's voice. But, you know, they were really the three-piece thing, and Jeff's guitar playing was very Jimmy Page and very there was a Hendrix-y kind of thing to them. And I remember thinking, like, these guys are really interesting, like really, really different. And then when they, by the time the first album came out, then it became this sort of presentation of, you know, the clothes and the whole thing. Like, they became very sort of like grandiose in a way that was very un-Canadian. But I think that they've done so well. And there was always this sort of story that they were like very successful in Australia. And I was always kind of like, I just took it at face value of like, okay. And then when I went to Australia and they're like, oh, are you from Canada? You know the Tea Party, mate? I'm like, I do know the Tea Party. You know, and you're like, and you guys do, and you guys do know them. So that means that the legend is true. That the Tea Party are, you know, successful in Australia. And I have Australian friends now who always talk, and they're, I'm just super excited because there's a new Tea Party track, and I'm on it. So, you know, kind of very cool.
Great catching up with Todd. The guy is fantastic. Really looking forward to that new Slash album. And that will do it for this week's edition of the show. Don't forget, follow us on social media, Scotty Mars Show on Facebook and Instagram, at Scotty Mars on Twitter. And until we chat again, have a great week.